So, I'm so f***ed up. I don't know when this is gonna end. I have another 40 miles to ride. Like, what the f***?
This is the Bike Pack Racing Podcast with Ezra Ward Packard and Andrew Onnerma. Welcome back to the Bike Pack Racing Podcast. This is episode number 26. I am your host, Ezra Ward Packard. I've said this before, but there are a number of results that make introducing certain athletes very fun. This might be one of the more fun ones. Two-time world 24-hour time trial world champion, Megan Häkkinen. Megan, how's it going today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for introducing me so generously. Stoked to be here.
I mean, you are the first world champion on the show. So I was excited when you reached out. You had been on our list of people to reach out for a while, and you just kind of beat me to it. Let's get going. I think the first thing is happy birthday. It was your birthday yesterday.
Thank you.
Do you have anything exciting on your birthday? Is that something that you celebrate or kind of just whatever, roll through it?
So I always try and get outside and do something. So the last couple of years I've gone snowshoeing. So I just went snowshoeing with my dad. It was a lovely day. We saw some moose tracks and it was really fun. I was going to have some friends over, but someone in the house is sick. So We're going to wait until next week, and it'll be kind of the first low key shindig post COVID. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Nice.
Socialization.
Okay. And then I know you are in Canada, British Columbia. Where in BC are you at?
I'm in Kelowna in the Okanagan Valley. So it's a pretty great place for outdoor enthusiasts. It's in this valley and there's kind of mountains on either side. There's a lot of good, kind of flat TT-esque cycling in the valley, but you can gain a lot of elevation really quick on dirt roads and some pavement up to the ski hills and stuff. And I think there's a lot of mountain bikers in the area. It's pretty good terrain for that.
Nice. And so just like following along with you on Instagram, it seems like you are all over the place all the time. Is this kind of like what you consider to be home base? Is this the kind of place that you return to after whatever big adventure, or is this just the place where you are for this winter?
So my parents live in Kelowna, and that's why I'm here. And they are a wonderful retired couple, and they let me live here without paying rent. And I try not to burden them too much. So I try and travel a lot so that I'm not around all the time. And I like to be home when they're away so I can take care of the house and dog sit for them. It's worked out really well. And as an athlete and a writer and someone who tries to do the most on a limited budget, not having to worry about rent is like a huge loophole that I've been able to really discover with my parents. And I'm just super grateful. Last year, I traveled a bit more than usual. I took like all my 2020 and 2021 plans and like mashed them together. So it was a little more all over the place than I think this year will be.
Okay. And that was one of the first questions that I had, because honestly, going through like the research I do for these podcasts, just like going through your website and all the different podcasts you have been on before, like you're kind of like prolific with like how much you're racing, how many tours you've done, the randonneuring part of your life. There was just so much information that I was like, this could be an 8-hour long podcast if we wanted it to be, if we like started at the beginning and, you know, went through the whole spectrum of everything. And so I guess my first question is, it is the start of 2023. I'm guessing that you are going to be doing races. The first question is like, how do you draw up a calendar? Last year, you had this absolutely massive year. The three like big ones that I think we're going to focus on today, Transcontinental, the Big Lonely, and then 24-hour TT World Championship. It's like, what are the things that like motivate you to do like such a wide variety of races? In addition, you did all these tours. So kind of just talk about your thought process about like writing up that schedule. Is that a very calculated thing, or is it, oh, there's an opportunity here, there's an opportunity here, let's combine them?
Yeah. So a lot of it is based off of like where I have friends and where I can kind of stay and opportunities that come up. So for instance, my friend and coach leads a training camp in Mallorca every year. So last year and this year, I'm going to go and lead group rides there for a month, and I'll do the 312, a kind of big Grand Fondo-esque event at the end. I had some friends offer me places to stay in like Switzerland and in the UK. So I kind of took those as chances to go someplace and train. Some events are bucket list items. So, and I think that's what the Transcontinental was. I signed up for that a few years ago and it seemed like one of those epic rides. And if I got a chance to do it, I really wanted to do it. So yeah, it's a mix of like opportunism and bucket list events. And then and trying to do things in my area. So the Big Lonely is in Oregon. It's only a couple states away. That's kind of why I went down there. And I don't know how I got into the 24-hour time trial thing. I just think it's a beautiful length of time, the, you know, full circle of the day. And I really, I don't know. It's kind of a challenging, it's a challenging discipline and I like it. So.
So before we jump headfirst into 2022, I guess I want to hear about like, what was your start in cycling? Like, how did you start riding the bike? How, I'm guessing you didn't start with like super, super long stuff. Like, how did you get to the point where you are doing, you know, 24-hour world time trial? That's a little bit different than what we normally focus on. Super excited to talk about that. But something like the Big Lonely, which is a multi-day bike packing race, or the Transcontinental, which is even longer than multi-day, over a week. So like, what was that start of ultra endurance cycling for you?
Yeah, so I started out commuting and then I got into touring and then I kind of took a break for a while. I had some knee injuries and I moved to a different city in the prairies in Canada for grad studies. And I didn't have a car. I wasn't getting out of the city much. And I discovered randonneur cycling as a way to travel and see more of the community around where I was living. And I loved the fact that it was non-competitive, but completely absurd, you know, these really, really long days. And I heard you talking to Corey Ostertag about randonneur cycling. It's not, yep. It's not so popular in Canada, but you know, there are clubs and it's a really good way to get into ultra cycling because it's quite supportive. And when I was randonneur cycling in Saskatchewan, I was using a commuter bike. It wasn't anything special. It had like mountain bike handlebars and like, I don't know, 35 or 38 tires on it. I started to get curious about, you know, even longer days. And that summer was the summer Lil Wilcox won the Trans Am bike race. And I was like, what? I didn't even know this was a thing. People race across countries. So then I got a road bike and I signed up for the Trans Am. And yeah,
and
after
that was, like, that was 2017.
Yeah, that's Trans Am. Right.
Okay, nice.
Yeah. And there really weren't as many bikepacking races on the calendar then. Like I'd never heard of events before. That was the first one I heard of. And I remember looking in like the fall of 2017 and the spring of 2018, and there just weren't too many events to choose from. So it's really exciting now. There's a lot more going on and there's road events and off-road events and mixed events and like hardcore mountain bike trail events. That's really something for any discipline. But yeah, I really liked racing. I'm quite competitive. I've had 3 ACL tears and 2 knee surgeries, so I am not allowed to do contact sports anymore. Okay. But I think I have a lot from my sports background that I can bring into to endurance cycling. Like, for instance, I kind of know the difference between a nagging pain that's just in the nuisance from like a pain that's actually going to take you out of a race, right? So I think I bring a lot from my previous activities and what I know about my body. And you can differentiate like a small, you know, pain that just is annoying from something that's really going to take you out and you know, cause you a lot of problems. And I feel like I have a good idea of how to train for things. You know, I know when I'm at peak fitness and I know when I'm not quite there yet and maybe should back away from something that I'm going to get in trouble with, right?
Yeah, for sure. So with the randonneuring on your kind of list of races that you've done, am I correct to assume that Paris-Brest-Paris is kind of like, that's the pinnacle of randonneuring events? Is that like the Tour de France of randonneuring essentially?
Yeah, that's what they call it. And it happens every 4 years. So it's kind of like Tour de France meets the Olympics.
Oh, except, it's only every 4 years. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that event? Because I had an old buddy who like was trying to qualify for it. I know there's a qualification process and he ended up kind of bailing on that dream. But can you just talk about Paris-Brest-Paris a little bit? I've never actually talked to anyone who's like participated in it before.
Cool. Yeah. So it happens every 4 years. I did it in 2019 and it's happening again in 2023. So a lot of people will be getting their qualifiers. Yeah, it's kind of one of the longest running events in the world, and it takes place in kind of the outskirts of Paris, and you go all the way to the Atlantic in Brest, and you have to qualify for it by doing the full Brevet series of 200, 300, 400, and 600 km rides, and then you get to register. And it's a huge mass start event, and you need to finish it in a set time window, either 80, 84, or 90 hours, depending on which wave you choose. But I think when I did it, there was like 6,500 people or something. It was
Oh,
pretty wild.
damn. Okay. Like
Yeah.
very large field. That's crazy.
Yeah. And the little towns it goes through, it's kind of magical. People get really excited about cycling in France, and this event in particular. So people are standing out on the side of the road day and night cheering you on, you know, LA, LA. And it feels really exciting to have spectators watching you, because I'm used to doing these long solo rides by myself and no one knows what I'm doing. And I just assume no one actually cares. So to have people who want to fill your bottles and standing on the side of the road making crepes or spaghetti and trying to feed you and help you through this really challenging ride and getting excited for you, it's really quite special. And there's just tons of riders on the road. You can, you know, work in packs if you want to, or just kind of noodle around by yourself. I ended up bumping into my friend Matthias from Germany in the middle of the first night, and we rode together most of the time. And ran into random other friends from past bikepacking events and both of our hometowns. Yeah, it's quite challenging though, just because you're riding with a bit of sleep deprivation, and there's control points where you can get food and everything, but there's like limited sleep facilities. And I think we tried to get a bed, like, you know, they have like cots on the ground at the turnaround point after 600K in Brest, and there wasn't anything. And so we just slept on the hard ground in the eating area, and it was too cold and I couldn't sleep. And Matthias had this like hero moment where he grabbed a bunch of cardboard boxes and like ripped them up and put them on the ground, so we had like a warmer surface to sleep on. It was pretty great. But yeah, it's this really big, exciting event. And I hung around at the finish after I came through and cheered people on. And it's this cobbly finish, and everyone's just like ready to pass out from exhaustion, but also like so totally overwhelmed with emotion that they finally made it across the line. So that was a really special experience in itself.
Very cool, very cool. So I feel like with your schedule, you almost have this like nice balance of like on-road and then off-road events. Is that something that you do on purpose? Like, what is your kind of relationship with tarmac ultra endurance events and then kind of like more bikepacky, something like the Big Lonely? Like, is there one that you prefer, or is it something that you do on purpose where it's like they like kind of fill different buckets for you? What is that sort of relationship like?
Yeah, I know, great question. I got a job as a caregiver in 2019, and the fellow that I worked for hired me because I was a cyclist, and I said I'd be willing to learn how to mountain bike because he did adaptive mountain biking. And I was like, sure, I'll like go in the woods with you. And it was through working as a caregiver for him that I kind of got off the road for the first time and realized like how beautiful it is at all, on the trail and all of these places in and around my community were completely different, like out in the woods. And he made fun of roadies all the time. Why am I riding around on the side of the highway when I could be out in the bush having fun by myself among the bear and the deer instead of like the trucks? So in 2021, I got my Salsa Cutthroat, and that's kind of my off-road adventure rig, and just started looking for events to do with that. There's a lot more bikepacking races, I think, that are mixed surface and gravel in my area. There's not really that many road events, so it did open up opportunities for me. I still love roadside cycling, like especially in Europe and some of those great roads in like Switzerland and Mallorca, like oh, the speed and the views, it's beautiful and incredible. But I think that a lot of places, like for instance where I live in the Okanagan, there's a lot more to explore if you can get off the pavement, or if you're willing to kind of link up pavement and trail and road to make these really interesting routes and kind of discover different passages. You know, there's just a huge logging and mining history here, so there's so many places to explore.
So when you are thinking about like training for, because like it's ultra endurance cycling, but at the same time, like something like the 24-hour World Time Trial Championships is so much different than the Transcontinental Like, do you change how you train leading up to the transcontinental? Are you someone who follows a regimented training program, or are you a little bit more free flowing? I know touring is something that you are also like super passionate about and still go on tours. So is that like very much part of your training? I guess like what is kind of your training principles that you follow to have like such great success in these events?
Yeah, so I like the indoor trainer a lot. I actually use Trainer Road and I train pretty consistently indoors in the winter and when I'm home. When I'm not home, I try and replicate some of those like high intensity interval workouts on the road. And I don't do outdoor workouts like on the training program. I just like set a timer for like 3 minutes and I'll go harder for 3 minutes and I'll take 3 minutes off and just do some repeats like that. Pretty like basic stuff, but just to kind of change the intensity around. One of the big considerations for me is if there's going to be like a lot of elevation in an event or not. Like in the transcontinental, there was so much climbing and I kind of tried to emulate that in my training by doing a lot of hill climbs, and I was in Switzerland and England and Wales, so there was plenty of places to go up. For the 24-hour TT, the one that I did down in Borrego Springs, it's quite flat, so I spent a lot more time on my indoor trainer in the aero bars trying to get used to that position. And I don't love riding my TT bike outdoors. I just don't feel like it's super safe to be in the aero bars, and you don't have as much vision around you. And I just would prefer to ride it indoors, as lame as that sounds. And I actually did quite a few kind of just longer rides on my Salsa Cutthroat up in the woods to kind of get the time on the bike, even though it was a different bike. It probably wasn't the smartest way to train. It would have been smarter, I think, to be on the TT bike more, but it's a little bit dull compared to compared to other things, so.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So you mentioned the Transcontinental. That's an event that's always kind of fascinated me. What is, I guess the first question is like, what is the Transcontinental? If you could go through that, and then what kind of like drew you to that event? Because it really is like such a unique event. Like, there really is not much like the Transcontinental. So give the listeners a quick rundown of what it is and what drew you to it.
Yeah, for sure. So the Transcontinental is a self-supported single-stage bikepacking race across Europe. It's mostly on pavement, and it was started by Mike Hall. So it's kind of one of the original races, aside from like the Tour Divide and stuff. But it's supposed to be like a beautifully hard challenge, and it's a self-navigating race where you have to hit four checkpoints and get to the finish line. And it's around 4,000 kilometers. This year was a bit more than that. But when you get to the checkpoints, there are these mandatory parcours that you have to do, and you have to, ride the section exactly as written. But the rest of the event is self-navigating, so you get to create this route across Europe and ride it and see how good of a route planner you are. And there's a lot of things that go into route planning. Are you, going to pick busier roads that might be faster? Are you going to pick, shortcuts through the mountains that have a lot more elevation but are shorter? Just so many things to think about when you're doing that. And it's a pretty big event. I think there was 250 single like solo riders this year, and they say only one in three people who entered the lottery got a spot. So
Oh, damn. Okay.
it's a pretty big event. And I think out of that there was maybe like 90 finishers, like official finishers. So yeah, I think that's kind of the down low on it. The 2022 edition went from Gerardsberg in Belgium to Burgas on the Black Sea in Bulgaria, through checkpoints in Krupka, Czech Republic, Passo di Gavia in Italy, Dermator National Park in Montenegro, and Transalpina in Romania. So
Okay.
not a straight line.
So when you're like just like on the navigation aspect of it, you have these mandatory parkours. And so is it something that you have like done months of research on the course beforehand and you kind of have different options? Or is it you do the mandatory parkours and then you stop and you're like, okay, I'm done. Now how do I get to the next point? Like, what sort of tools are you using? Because I like every route I make is based off of like Strava heat maps where some days I'm like, I don't really want to explore. I just want to ride on roads that are good because a whole bunch of people have ridden them. And then there's other days where I'm like, oh, it seems like there's one line on this. How does this work? So what sort of tools are you using? Like, how much time does it take to like actually map out this massive ride across Europe?
Yeah. So one of the things I say in preparation that those who, you know, prepare will be rewarded. And I think that's so true. The more time you spend figuring out your route and comparing alternates, and the more you, the less likely things will go wrong, and stuff will always go wrong. But the more research you do, the better chances you have of making it across the continent. I started about a month out, and I should have started further out. I just procrastinated a bit because it's such a daunting task. And once I got started, I kind of got rolling easily. But I used Komoot, which isn't my usual route maker, but they had listed the parkours in Komoot. So it seemed like a good way to kind of make sure I was getting those sections correctly into my route plan.
Okay, so you know those beforehand. Those aren't like you show up at a checkpoint and it's like, surprise, you have to go up this mountain climb. Okay, so you know those beforehand. Cool.
Yeah,
okay.
That's correct. So they give you the checkpoints I think coordinates, like, you know, latitude and longitude, and then they give you the route, like a little segment that you actually have to ride. The checkpoints aren't necessarily on the route, so you kind of have to make sure you don't miss them, and people definitely do miss them and then have to go back or just like decide that's it, I'm done. I heard stories about people like going, you know, over a big pass and the checkpoint is halfway up it, and then they go down the other side and realize they've missed it, and they're just like, oh god, like this is gonna take me 4 hours to go back, like okay, I guess I have to do it. You definitely don't want to be doing stuff on the fly. I realized there was a few times where I was riding through Italy once, and I saw this, I saw my route and it went up into the hills, and I was like, why would I go up here? This is a bunch of elevation that I don't want or need. I'm going to take this fast road. And I just hopped on it. And then I went through two tunnels, and tunnels are legal for cyclists in Italy. And I didn't even think about it. And then I called the race director because I'm like a super honest, kind, polite Canadian. And I was like, I went through two tunnels. What do I do? And he was like, ooh, that's illegal. You have to get back to where, you know, you have to get back safely to the spot where you diverged from your route, and then ride your original route, and you won't get a penalty. Otherwise, you get a penalty. And I ended up doing this like loop around a lake, which looked completely pointless, like on Strava and on the tracker. People were like, Megan, what are you going on a sightseeing tour? Are you going for a little ice cream, like swimming holiday in Italy? And I was like, I want to ride clean. I don't want any penalties. And in the end, I got one big penalty for crossing an illegal border between Montenegro and Bosnia, I think. But planning on the fly can definitely get you in trouble. I think you're much smarter when you're planning from home than when you're out there sleep deprived and trying to be competitive and maybe just not making the smartest decisions. And that being said, like there are times where I think you definitely have to reroute because you run into something unexpected and you have to figure it out.
So when you said illegal border, what does that mean? Like, I know the Transcontinental, just following along on Instagram, it seems like there's every year like some sort of controversy with the rules. And this year there was like everyone was racing to a ferry, which kind of a little bit of a throwback to BC Epic with that famous ferry. And like, can you talk about that aspect of it? Just like the rules of Transcontinental, like illegal border crossings. Like in my mind, the few times I've ridden in Europe, it's been like, you don't even know when you like cross over into another country, because it's like, wait, I was in France for like 15 minutes and now I'm back in Switzerland. And it's like so fluid. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So in the like EU and Schengen areas, it's really fluid. But when you get to Eastern Europe, there's like border crossings you have to go through. And I think they started maybe like Slovenia to Croatia. That might've been the first one I went through, and you have to like line up and wait. And usually as a cyclist, you can kind of be a bit sneaky and get in front of people, or, you know, it's pretty easy on a bike, but you still have to go through these borders and get your passport stamped. It's much easier than the Canada-US border. That is like by far the most frustrating border crossing that I regularly go through. It's such a pain in the neck. But between, I think it was, Bosnia-Herzegovina and Montenegro, you could either go north to a proper border crossing or south, and they both entailed bigger roads, more traffic, more elevation gain. And you could see this on the Strava heat map. There's like a little like road between the two countries, kind of a green border, local only crossing. And it saved tons of time, saved tons of elevation. And it was this like lovely, easy way to get between the two countries. I think it had been used in one of the previous editions of the TCR. And I wasn't going to do it because I didn't want to break any laws. But then I ran into another cyclist and he said he was doing it. And I didn't want him to get ahead of me. So then I did it as well. And I was like, oh, this is like the easiest crossing ever. No problem. You just, you know, slip through and you're at the checkpoint and the checkpoint for the race. And it's great. And then at the end of the race, they go through all the dots and they make sure nobody, you know, hopped on any trains or did anything that they shouldn't have. And they kind of levy the penalties. And that penalty, I think, was initially given 9.5 hours and maybe Whoa. They reduced it to 5.5 hours. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
So like what's like the reasoning for like such a harsh penalty? Because it's a border. So is like you said, local only, like I didn't realize that was like, does there have to be like an established border station? You have to mm-hmm. get your passport yeah. checked or else there's issues later on.
Yeah. So the rules of the TCR are like simple in theory. I think there's only like 10 of them. And one of them is basically you have to follow the laws of the countries that you're in. You can't go around breaking laws. And one of the laws of the countries is that you have to go through a proper border crossing and get your entry and exit stamps when you travel, right? So there was a risk that like when I left Montenegro, they'd be like, where's your entry stamp? How did you get here? But they didn't really look at my passport that well. And the guy at the border actually was like, good luck on your race. And I thought that was really sweet because again, I usually just assume people don't know what I'm doing. And the fact that he'd already seen enough racers that he had, you know, he was familiar with it, I thought was really cool. But yeah, just that it's breaking a law and that it did save a lot of time. I don't think it saved 9 hours. I think easily 4 to 6 hours though, because there was quite a bit of distance to go to the other two crossings and elevation. So
any other crazy stories on the transcontinental, any like highlights, lowlights from the experience?
Oh man. Yeah. It's just a wild ride. It was a long time to be on the road. I think I should have done some longer tours building up to it. I'd only done short bikepacking tours in the last few years. And I think it was just like kind of a struggle for me to be traveling and for so long at such a high speed. I was, you know, fatigued and my devices weren't staying charged. And I was just kind of like struggling to keep my wits about me. One of the coolest experiences I had was probably getting to the checkpoint in Transalpina just before midnight. And there's no real reason to get there before midnight. The checkpoint, you know, it still counts if you get there after midnight. I just really wanted to be there while the volunteers were awake. And I set this goal for myself. And so I entered this kind of mountainous region in Romania after like a hot, sluggish day and just kind of really dragging myself along and not, you know, not really feeling like much of a bike pack racer. And then I entered the mountains kind of at sunset and it was getting darker. And I was like, I got to make it to this checkpoint and just kind of steadily climbing into the darkness and into the night. And, you know, you go through a town and pass a few guest houses and just making that decision, like, no, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep going. There's no reason to stop. And it was just a really like beautiful, empowering experience. And then I got to the checkpoint and slept on the ground for a few hours and then did another climb and then 43 kilometers of hardcore gravel riding, which was
that was very fun to follow along on Instagram just because everyone is on their like, you know, pretty fast road bikes and they did not expect to have to do 45 clay or 45k of chunky gravel, and it was some carnage happened in that section for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. So I was wearing my road shoes. I didn't want to bring mountain bike shoes. I actually picked up another pair of just like slip-ons the day before because I was afraid about clipping and unclipping and having to do a big hike bike. So I rode with these like little purple shoes that I bought and ended up, you know, hopping off and walking quite a bit. And like the one time where I wiped out, there was a pairs team like around the bend behind me and they watched me literally like launch myself off the mountain. And they were like, oh my God. And I was like, no, I'm fine. This is just me riding a bike. but they were like, you have to ride ahead of us. We have to make sure you're gonna be okay. And I was like, you guys, come on. Like, I'll ride ahead of you if I'm faster than you, but just go on. It was really ridiculous. I'm glad that I made it through with no flats and only a few small flesh wounds.
So with something like the Transcontinental, this is predominantly on road, which kind of like changes things a little bit in a few different ways. One, I'm assuming it's like you can be like more calculated with like resupply points, and they're more available in a way where, since you are on pavement, you're able to just like ride a little bit faster, where if you're like on gravel, so much of your speed is dictated by like the terrain and the type of gravel. And then the other like thing that in my mind changes is like the sleep deprivation aspect. Like, you are on open roads where so many bike packing races in the United States and Canada are kind of on gravel roads, where if you're riding in the middle of the night, there's like not traffic. Does that like, do these things like change anything for how you approach a race, where you are like more likely to make a more like detailed strategic plan of like, okay, I can do 15 miles per hour for this amount of time, so I know I can get there at this time. And then like that sleep deprivation aspect, like, are you like more cautious with your sleep deprivation since you are on open roads, or is that just like not really a concern?
I think the resupply is much, much easier because there's so much more of it in Europe compared to like, you know, riding through Canada or the US, where you've got these little like gas stations every, you know, 50 miles or something. Like, they're quite long distances. And you're correct about being able to predict your speed a lot more accurately. And, you know, if I'm going to go into a climb, I know that's going to slow me down quite a bit, but in general, you can average your speed, pretty close. So you can guess your average pretty close. With the sleep deprivation, it's different being on open roads for sure. I think a lot of the roads in Europe, there wasn't a lot of traffic though. And I think about the night riding I did, the only danger I ever felt was like the dogs in Eastern Europe. I didn't have a lot of traffic on the road or cars passing me. There's some of the roads in Bulgaria I wouldn't have wanted to be on at night. Like, kind of, there was a couple of roads that were quite busy, like rutted out with like, you know, from big trucks, and there was no shoulder, and they're just not the kind of roads I would want to be on a bike at night. It wasn't very much fun on the day. But for the most part, like, I was on pretty, pretty low traffic roads at night, and the sleep deprivation, I kind of got into this pit early on, and I should have been getting more sleep the first few nights, and then I didn't get out of it. I think one of the most challenging things for me though is difficult terrain. Like, I did an event called the Alberta Rockies 700, and there was a lot of single track, and it was so like mentally fatiguing. I felt like I couldn't get by with as little sleep as I could for, say, the BC Epic, which is like mostly rail trail, so you can kind of just hammer like mindlessly. Whereas with single track, you have to be on the ball like every single second, and I'm not, like, I'm pretty new to technical riding, so something like the Transcontinental, you definitely have to have your wits about you, but I didn't find it quite as fatiguing as, say, like navigating a single track forest in like grizzly country at night. Like, that's a little bit, that would be a little bit harder.
Yeah. So then the next big event you did was the Big Lonely, which is kind of, you are part of Northwest Competitive Adventure.
Like, that's right.
One of the teams you race for. Yep. And that's like one of their big events. Jesse, we've talked about Jesse on the podcast a few different times. We really need to get him on the show.
Yeah, he's so cool.
One of the questions I have is, do you notice any differences between, I guess, like American bike pack racing and like European bike pack racing? Are there any like fundamental differences you see between the two sports? I'm just thinking about, like, recently, I think it's Trans-Siberia is now enforcing like a mandatory sleep rule, which there was like kind of this clear divide where a whole bunch of people were like, this is a great idea, this is great for safety. And then there was also a whole bunch of other people, which kind of felt like North American based, that were like, we don't like this. Like, we like the way that we're doing it. And just like with the organization of races, where you go over to Europe and it seems like there's a lot more structure to things, where so many of the races in the United States are just like organized on Instagram or Facebook. And it's like, show up at this time, make a $25 donation, and you don't get a route queue. There's no checkpoints. It's kind of like Scout's Honor, point A, point B, go have fun, go race. So do you notice any of these differences? Is there like a style that you prefer?
Yeah, I think like one big difference for me is I've only ridden in Europe on my road bike. I've never had a different bike there. So I've done like kind of purely road events.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, there's a lot of bike packers, and there's a market for an organized event where there is a fee and, you know, maybe some media crew and an after party and all that kind of stuff. Whereas in North America, like, yeah, most of the events I've done have been free or like a donation to the local trail society. So it's much more low key and underground. And I don't know how much that's going to change. Like, I know Nathan Jones, who does the Trans Am, is organizing a race series kind of in the Pacific Northwest, and the entry fee is like $50 for each of them. You know, it's like, you literally just get the tracker and the route. There's not as much, I guess, there's not as much race enforcement or stuff that you get, I guess, for your entry. I think the treatment of like outside support is very different in like a lot of North American races. I think that trail angels are acceptable creatures, and in Europe, I think it's more on that transcontinental philosophy where like you are doing the self-support, and that means no support from anyone. Like, even if you don't know them, someone can't give you an apple. Whereas in North America, if someone gives you an apple, it's like, okay, cool, why not? It's just like trail magic. So I think that was one big difference. Yeah, when I did the North Cape 4000, my coach lives in Switzerland, and him and his wife stood on the side of the route, and they were handing out, like, I think water and fruit to racers, and they wanted to give me something, right? They wanted to kind of support me, but they were like, oh, we can't support Megan because that's outside the rules, so we'll support everyone, we'll stand here all day on the first day of the race and give stuff to everyone. And not a single person accepted their like offer until I came along, and I was like, again, the first North American, so I was like, sure, of course, why not? Yeah, so I thought that was kind of a funny difference, and they were surprised that nobody was accepting help, but yeah
it's just those like different cultures, different mentalities,
I think. So yeah with the sleep one, I think it'll be interesting. Like, personally, I don't really care either way. I feel like it's up to the race director, and if I had a problem with it, I might not sign up for an event that had a mandatory sleep break. But if I thought it looked like a cool race, like, I would follow the rules. That's fine by me. So
yeah, right, like the race director makes the rules. You can just sign up or don't sign up. You're not forced to do that event. So with Big Lonely, how was that experience? You first woman overall, or first woman, third overall, you set a new women's fastest known time. Talk about Big Lonely a little bit.
Yeah, the Big Lonely was a really cool event, because I'm a Northwest competitive athlete. I actually emailed Jesse beforehand and I asked him if he needed any help or any volunteers on the event. And I said that I would love to volunteer and get involved and help out. And if you don't need me, I'd like to race it. And he was like, Megan, you should race it. And I was like, okay, cool, thanks for your blessing. and I'm so glad I did. It came at a really great time for me because I had finished the Transcontinental, and then I had a knee injury, and I signed up for the Big Sky Spectacular in Montana, and I actually didn't end up starting because my knee was hurt, and it was just like kind of a bummer. And I get a little bit down when I'm injured, and it healed itself up, and I had just finished doing a 5-day stage gravel race here in the Okanagan, and it was super fun. I had a great time, but I am not like a day racer. I am a like ultra endurance racer. Like, if I'm on the bike for 3 or 4 hours, like, I feel you just have to race so hard, and I don't have that like fast power movement combination. I am way more of a, you know, grind it out over a longer time period kind of person. So I felt really great during that event, but I looked forward to the Big Lonely to just get to be outdoors and kind of be in the saddle and really do what I do well. The route is like I think it's about a 350-mile loop around Bend, and it takes in some single tracks, some gravel roads, some paved scenic bikeway, and it's really, I think, a labor of love from Jesse. It's just an awesome route, and there's not very many resupply, so you have to pack, you know, quite smart, and it's in October, so the weather can just be all over the place. It's quite high up in Bend, so they've had snow and rain and terrible mud in previous years, but this year we had really great weather, which I think helped get some fast times on the course. And although it did get cold at night, it wasn't freezing or anything like that. Yeah, so I went in pretty strong and pretty stoked. There was a pre-ride kind of get together the evening before, so I got to meet a whole bunch of cool people. So I was like just really amped up and in my element and in a good mood. My partner James, also a Northwest competitive athlete, was racing as well. So we were staying with a friend of his, and we biked to the start. And you know, it's dark, and you roll out down this single track with a bunch of other bikepackers, and it was just a really lovely experience, and kind of, you know, finding your groove and getting into the rhythm of things. And I like blew past the first resupply in Sisters because I was drinking like my drink mix out of my hydration bladder, so I didn't really need much else, and I had a whole bunch of snacks. And I think that kind of, you know, helped me get some momentum, and yeah, it was a beautiful course. I rode a bit with one or two other people for kind of 15, 20 minute stints, and just kind of kept trucking. And I missed the magic fridge in like Asheville or Ashland. I guess it's like a resupply point with a fridge. And I totally went past it and then ran out of water on the climb up the Ochocos. And then I was just a little bit miserable, and the sun was setting, and I was veering back and forth across the road to try and like see if there was water in any of the dry river beds, and there was nothing.
No.
And I was
like, yeah,
Megan, you're such an idiot. And yeah. And so I was like rationing water for a while, just having these tiny little sips. And oh yeah, got to the top and you know, layered up and everything, and then just bombed down into this campground. And as soon as I saw the sign for the campground, it was just like a cartoon, like putting on the brakes, like and I pulled in and put my face under the faucet. It was such a great feeling. But yeah, I got to Prineville kind of about the midway point, maybe like 11, 12 o'clock at night, and I checked the tracker and I was in fifth place. And, you know, I was starting to feel a bit tired because I'd been up since like 4 something in the morning. And, you know, as soon as I saw I was in fifth place, I was like, all right, cool. Like there's people ahead of me, there's people behind me. Like I'm going to see if I can move up in the rankings. And yeah, I just headed out there really, really spinning hard. And the moon was up, and it was this like gorgeous full moon night. You know, you could have ridden without your bike lights. It was so perfect, and just some really beautiful terrain and quite quiet roads, and transitioned from pavement to gravel and wound up into the high desert. And there was a neutral water aid station. So the guy running it flagged me down. I totally would have blew by that as well. And filled my bottles and told me I was in third. And then I got pretty stoked because I'd like unknowingly passed two people in the desert in the middle of nowhere while they probably slept in pit toilets or something. And then, yeah, just tried to keep the momentum on. So I think I finished after 33 hours. So it was a really like, I think it's a really fun distance, you know, that kind of like 50-60 mile mark. And if you sleep, you can, you know, definitely turn it into a bit longer of an event. But you know, if you power through, you can kind of do it without too much sleep deprivation. And I did have a challenging time at the end. There was a lot of a single track. That's not really my forte. And I was just feeling like, you know, like I was tired. And you know, you're running into other
bikes. Yeah.
You run into people out there and they're unloaded bikes just out for day rides, right? And you're kind of like watching them enviously, you know, power up stuff that you're like barely turning the pedals on. And you're like, oh, I wish I could just like offboard all of these things.
Offboard all these things and have fresh legs, and then I'd be flying. But instead, I'm just crawling. I'm just moving. That's all that matters.
That's exactly what I told myself.
Very cool. I'm just so fascinated by like, you go from Big Lonely, which is like 100% off-road single track, and then the next big thing I have is 24-hour world time trial championships, which is kind of like a foreign world. Like I feel like you are one of the few athletes that actually bounces back and forth between these disciplines, because they are like so different. Mm. Like 24-hour world championships, I just have so many questions. The first one is, it's a time trial, and like coming from the road background, like the number one rule of riding a TT bike is that you stay in the saddle, right? Even if you are just trying to maintain that aerodynamic position as much as possible, because like in TTs, aero is everything. And I guess my first question is like, how do you stay in the saddle for 24 hours and not just like die? Because even in bikepacking races, I remember starting Arkansas High Country Race, I was riding with a rider who had never done like a super long event. And he was like, why are you getting out of the saddle so much? And I'm like, because we're going to be out here for a week. Like you don't want to stay sitting in the saddle. Like, that's just a recipe for disaster. So I guess my first question, is that something that you like train? Like, it just kind of blows my mind to just spend 24 straight hours just in the saddle, because the course is not very, there's not a whole bunch of climbing. It's not like you go up this nice climb that's and descend true. Down. It's like pretty flat. Like, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I think like the Transcontinental did help me prepare for it, just because I was in the saddle quite a lot during that event, right? And not exactly the same, but you're just putting in big days, day after day after day, and you're really trying to make use of the aero bars when it's flat and when you can. And I think I have a pretty good relationship with my saddle. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. I don't have like serious issues compared to some people. And I run the same saddles on, I guess, my road bike and my gravel bike, and then I have a different one on the TT, but they're quite similar, so there's not a lot of difference. And there is a small climb. I don't remember what the elevation is, but there's a little bit of a climb. So I you know, shifted upright for the climb on that to give myself a different, just a little bit of a different positioning. Sometimes I stood to pedal just like a tiny bit, just to get up out of the saddle. And then I stopped a few times, but not very many. And I usually just kind of like threw myself in the camp chair that my crew had pulled out for me, or on the ground, something like that. Yeah, it is really about being in the saddle and then being in that aero position. And I don't have the most aggressive aero position. I think if I want to do better at this event, I should do you know, a series of bike fits to really dial that in. And I think that I can make some more gains in that regard. But I think it's better to be in a less aero position, but be able to hold it for 24 hours versus someone who's like super low, but ends up like not being able to stay there. And you really see by the second half of the race, people are, you know, they're sitting upright, they're moving around, they're not doing things like according to plan, I think. So yeah, I think more important than just being in the saddle is being in the saddle and aero.
So with a 24-hour race, like, what is the running time compared to stop time? Like, are you trying to spend as absolute much time on the bike as possible, or like, what does that like breakdown look like? Is it every 4 hours I'm going to take a 5-minute break? Like, is it something that you plan out beforehand, or is it more, I really need to sit down in this chair, I need to make sure that my bike, there's something wrong with my bike, this is a good opportunity to take a quick break?
Yeah, I plotted out my breaks beforehand based on layering up in the evening, like stopping to pee in the middle of the night. I just anticipated that, and then delayering in the morning, because those things, you know, it takes a little bit of time to throw your arm warmers and your jacket on, and you don't know exactly what you are going to want until you get out there and kind of feel the temperatures. And I tried not to stop for no reason. I always, you know, made sure I had to stop for something or other. When I did it in 2019, I think my stop time was like 15 minutes. And this time it was more, but it was kind of a weird technical thing. There's a long course and a short course, and they switched to the short course when there's about an hour and a half left on the clock. And so I pulled into the pit area like 10 minutes before they were switching to the short course. And I had like nailed a pothole really bad. And I was kind of afraid my wheel was going to like explode while I was out on the long course. And if, you know, if you have to get assistance while you're on the course, that whole lap doesn't count and you waste a bunch of time. So I had this fear about heading out on another long lap in case I had some sort of issue. So I waited those 10 minutes and just literally sat there in the chair and twiddled my thumbs so that I could go out in the short course. At that time, I kind of, you know, knew that I was going to break the record anyways, so there wasn't like a lot of stress, and the fear of like having something terrible happen when I was a long course just kind of overrode my desire to get, you know, slightly more mileage in. So I think I was off the bike for maybe like 25 minutes this time, which felt like a long time, but doesn't sound like a lot. So yeah, just stopping to layer up, to delayer, to use the toilet and get sunscreen. And working with your crew is something that's very different from solo bike pack racing. Like I found that I need to learn how to communicate with people and to not do anything and just tell them to do it for me, because the idea is that when you're stopped, you're relaxing as much as possible, you know. So if I need sunscreen, somebody else puts that on me. If I need arm warmers, they put the arm warmers on me, and I just stand there like a Barbie doll. So doing stuff like that is not like, it's intuitive to want to take care of yourself, right? So telling people to do it seems weird and a little bit rude. Yeah, just say things politely and remember that, you know, it's your job to relax while you're in the pit as much as possible.
I remember I was listening to, I don't remember the exact name of the podcast, but the Trainer Road Athlete podcast, where you were talking to Jonathan, and you were talking, and I found this absolutely fascinating because, again, this is like almost a foreign world discipline to me, that you, your parents would call you and you would have your phone set to auto pick up. And so you wouldn't have to pull out your phone. And so you could like tell them exactly what they needed. And I thought that was so cool because it's like, kind of like an F1 pit crew, like that sort of communication. So you just pull in and they know like, hey, my chain needs to get lubed and I want this, this, and this, or I don't need anything, good to go. I just thought that was like so cool, like, and how well thought out that was, because like, are radios allowed? Could you be in like constant communication? Okay. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. Like there's some dead zones in the course. So you have to be careful when you call people because, you know, you might not get service. And I think the radios, people have had issues with them from what I've heard from listening to other folks talk about their races. So the calling thing seems to work the best if you know where the dead zones are on the course. And it was nice just to talk to somebody, I think, and remember that, like, you know, it was just nice to have a little bit of company, which is funny because I didn't talk to anyone on the phone during the whole transcontinental. And here I am on a 24-hour race talking to someone like once or twice an hour. but my crew this year was my parents again, and a friend of ours, Randy Horton from Temecula down in California. And he was supposed to crew for another rider who ended up not racing because of a knee injury. So we kind of pulled him in to crew for me at the last minute. My partner, James, was racing it on a single speed. Oh, sorry. He's going to kill me if he hears this. A fixed gear. They're very
fixed
different.
Gear, fixed gear. Yeah. Don't want to offend the fixed gear community. Bad move. No. Bad move.
So yeah, we had three crew members for the two of us, and I think it was really good to have Randy because, like, my mom needs to sleep a little bit. She's not gonna stay up for 24 hours, and I think you want to give your crew a chance to sleep if you can. You don't want sleep deprived people helping sleep deprived people. I think, you know, having everyone with some downtime is a really good thing. But yeah, just having, you know, that constant kind of contact, and I can let them know exactly what I want. And I'm not really that picky about things. I kind of use a drink mix, and, you know, somebody stuffs food into one pocket and I was eating like bananas cut up into pieces, like boiled salted potatoes cut up into pieces, and then like gummy bears, real classy.
You beat me to that question because my next question was like, what does nutrition look for it? Like, is it... Yeah, you just answered that question. And I guess the other question that I have is mentally, like, this is so different than a bikepacking race or the transcontinental or anything else, because you're like in these new places and you like have things to look at, and there's like all these calculations that you're making. Like, is there a mental, is like the 24-hour distance like harder in a way? Like, in my mind, I would imagine it being harder since you're on. The other question I forgot to ask is like, how long is the long loop? And then how long is the short loop?
Yeah, I think the long loop's like 18, 19 miles and the short loop's like 4 miles. One of the reasons I enter races is because I think they're going to be taking me through beautiful landscapes. And I sign up for events because I think that they're going to be like, you know, visually and emotionally satisfying places to visit. And the 24-hour course is actually quite beautiful, but you are doing the same loop again and again in the dark for most of the time, actually. And so it's a lot different than a bikepacking race where, you know, you never know what's going to be around the corner, what kind of like gorgeous surprise it's going to await your, you know, viewpoint. And, you know, instead you just get very familiar with every single corner and cactus. And there's all these weird like metal sculptures on the desert, which are pretty entertaining, like day or night. But there's not like a lot to see. I think the highlights were sunset and sunrise when the sky just goes all crazy. And that's always a special joy. But yeah, it's kind of just, I guess, the beauty of experiencing that time frame on the bike, which is what I like about the 24, and really being able to kind of like test the limits of human performance and see what your body is capable of, kind of on a, you know, it's not like a closed course, but it's a set loop, and having that support. And I think it's nice because you know, a lot of supported races you have a follow vehicle behind you, which I don't really like the idea of. Like, I want to ride my bike to be free. I don't want to have a follow vehicle like burning gas in my wake. That just seems kind of dumb to me. But the 24, there's this 24-hour race, there's a pit crew that, you know, is stationary and you're on your own out on the course, which I prefer, I guess. So it's nice to know you have that support waiting for you, but I'd rather be independent when I'm out there biking. Yeah. Well, did you have another question? I can't remember. I was just rambling there.
Oh, it's all good. You answered multiple of them. I guess the other question I had is just in terms of like pacing, like how do you pace something that is so controlled, where we talked with like bike packing and transcontinental, like obviously you hit this massive alpine climb, you're going to slow down a little bit, but with something like 24 hours, like do you ride super consistent, steady power, or are you trying to like negative split? Like what does that sort of look like?
Yeah, I tried to go for steady power. And the first time I did the event, I was just using like RPE. And I had, you know, been on the bike a lot that year. So I had a really good idea of what I could do. And I think I paced it quite well. And then the next time I did it in 2019, I went out with heart rate. And then I didn't follow the heart rate numbers I was using. I went out harder than I should have. And I knew I was going out too hard, but I didn't want to believe it. And then I blew up in the middle of the night. And it was such a struggle. Like the whole second half, I was just so, yeah. I'd kind of burnt my matches too soon and it was really hard. And this year I tried to be a bit more conservative and I think I paced it at 0.65 intensity factor and it seemed to be the right number for me. I could really maintain it. And I actually got this really nice little bump in the morning when I took off all my layers because I was more aero. So I gained like a kilometer and a half, like almost a mile an hour of speed from taking off my vest and my sleeves and my, you know, bulky shoe covers and everything. So, or maybe I was just stronger because like, I don't know, it was daylight, but my power number stayed the same and my speed went up. It was really like awesome. I need to work on my like nighttime kit, I guess, to get that more dialed in. I think it's a very challenging event to pace though, because you have no idea what you're going to feel like at the end. And it's easy for us to sit here and be like, oh, you know, like I have a deep inner pool of strength and I'll pull on that to be really strong in the final hours. But like, you're just so beat down by being on the bike. Those last few hours get really, really hard. And I think I did do a really good job of pacing it because at sunrise I was in like 10th place and just coming in to lead female, and then I finished second place. So I feel like a lot of people ahead of me probably didn't pace it as well and they were kind of dropping off. And I guess the other things that impact people are the heat and the cold. It can be quite cold at night and that gets challenging, you know, it's hard on your muscles. And then the heat in the day, it's also draining. So I know some people who ride a bit harder at night, anticipating that, you know, they're just not going to be able to put out the same power in the day when it's hot. So they try and go a little bit faster at night and expect to slow down in the day because it starts at 5 p.m. So it's kind of, you know, dark by 6:20 or something.
And it's always in, it's Borrego Springs, California?
That's right. Yeah. They've been doing it there for like maybe 5 years or something. It's a pretty cool community because there's no stoplights or anything. There's one four-way stop and there's a volunteer flagger there that waves you through if there's no one else around, which is really nice. And there's, you know, there's some agricultural workers and snowbirds. There's a few hotels. It's a pretty low-key, quiet place. So I think it works quite well. The surface isn't perfect. Like it's a little bit rough and everything feels worse on a TT bike. Like it's so stiff and those big aero disc wheels, like it's just, it's really punishing on your whole body by the end of the event, every little bump in the road. But I do think it's a pretty good course.
Nice. Very cool. So you did it. You came in second place in 2018, won in 2019, and then repeated in 2022. Do you think this is going to be an event that you go to year after year after year? Like, does it still like have that draw to you? And I guess like, what areas do you think you can like improve? Like you are a two-time world champion at it. Like, what are the things that you can adjust to like get a few more hours at, or a few more miles out of that 24-hour period?
Yeah, like I think I'm going to give it a miss this year because it's a lot of effort to prepare to go down there and then, you know, getting a crew on board and it's just a lot of planning and preparations and a lot of like minutia, like labeling all of my kit so that my parents know what to give me when I say I want it. And, you know, this time they got confused about some of my cords and I realized I need to label all my power cords being like power cord for my computer one, power cord for, you know, my cell phone. Yeah, it's a lot of preparation. So I think I'm going to give it a miss this year, and then I'd like to do it again in 2024. And I ideally, like, 1 year I'd like to hit 500 miles. There's only been one woman to ever do that, and that's Amanda Coker, and she did it in Florida. No woman has done it on this course before. So I think that's a goal that I would like to hit. And I did like 478.8 miles, so I've only got 21 and change to go, but that's still almost a mile an hour of pace increase, which is like quite a bit. In terms of what I could do to improve it, I think I should do some bike fits on my TT bike. I don't have a super high-end TT bike. It's like a 2016 Cervelo P2 or something that I got used for a pretty reasonable price. I could get a disc wheel. Like most people who do more than 500 miles have a disc wheel. Again, I don't have one. I'm using a friend's borrowed Zips from like 19 or 2010 or something. They're pretty old too. So I think there's some like obvious equipment upgrades. And then in I mentioned I could probably try and improve my nighttime aerodynamics, and I'm not sure exactly what that would look like. Like I was wearing a vest, which maybe flapped around a bit or something, but yeah. And I could get a better helmet. They have those like those dipped helmet, not what's the word, the ones that kind of fill in your neck area to make a more aerodynamic shape.
Yeah,
That's
TT
another
helmet,
thing.
aero helmet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Teardrop. Yep.
Yeah, teardrop. That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
So yeah, so those are the kind of equipment upgrades. And then in terms of the fitness, I think just being really consistent with my training and like hoping not to get injured or sick or anything. I think those things like take a lot out of you and in terms of like, your progressive year after year build. And I think one of the things that's hard is coming into it with the right amount of taper, right? Like it's kind of hard to know when you're perfectly tapered because you don't want to have any fatigue in your legs, but you also want to be like, ready to go and not out of shape either. But yeah, it's a cool event. I think it's something like I said, I'd like to do in 2024, but not this year. And yeah, recommend people if you're keen to ride for 24 hours. This one in Borrego Springs is pretty fun. I think that there's other 24-hour events as well, but if you live near a place, give it a shot.
Do you get a rainbow jersey or any like world champion apparel for winning the world championships? Or is I know it's like not UCI sanctioned, but like Gravel Worlds out in Nebraska, they did a funny play off of the UCI World Championship jersey. Anything like that or nothing?
I got a bottle of tequila. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's
Yeah, it was
something.
nice. It was a Siempre sipping tequila and yeah.
I feel
but
like there's a
yeah.
missed opportunity to like make some funky 24-hour world TT championship jersey. Like the
Yeah,
organization needs to
I
jump
hear
on
you.
that. Like that's like one of the coolest things. Like the rainbow stripes are, in my mind, like the coolest jersey that you can imagine that you can wear. So what does 2023 look like? Do you have kind of a set plan for this next year? I know we talked a little bit about like bucket list. Like, are there any events that are, at the very, very top? I think you already answered this question. You don't like a follow car, so maybe not a ram attempt coming up in the future. You've done some pretty crazy long off-road stuff. Is like Tour Divide something that would interest you? Like, what are those like big long-term goals? And then what does 2023 look like?
Yeah, so Tour Divide is on my bucket list for sure.
Yes.
I think after my experience in the Transcontinental, I need to go back and build into these longer races because like I was a bit of a shit show the whole time, and I think that would be like terrible on the Tour Divide. So I'd like to just get some more experience touring and racing, and hopefully this year I'll get to tour some of the route because I live in BC, so I can kind of easily get out to Banff and hop on the trail for a week or so. So that would be really cool. I'm heading to Mallorca to lead group rides there for my coach in April, and I'm going to do the Mallorca 312 to top or to kind of finish that out. And then I'm coming home to do the Buckshot in BC in Kamloops, close to where I live. I think that's about 400, 500 kilometers. It's yeah, mixed surface race, and it's pretty fun. It's a new route every year. I've never raced it. I've just done the routes, and I just signed up for the Lost Elephant, and that's a self-supported mixed surface race here in BC as well, in Cranbrook. I think it's a little gnarly. I think there's often like hike bikes and bushwhacking and creek crossing. I think it's in a pretty rough area, so it should be short and challenging, but not necessarily short in time. And then I guess like I have a couple other events that interest me, but I haven't committed to them yet. The Dark Divide, the new Washington bikepacking race, sounds pretty cool. That's in August. And then the Idaho Smoke and Fire in September sounds pretty cool. I would consider going back to Big Lonely again. That's just a really fun event, and I would happily ride that route again. And I was invited to go to Chelsea, Quebec for a Canadian Shield bikepacking summit. So I'm going to be the keynote speaker there and just like do some bikepacking out in Quebec and Ontario afterwards for a couple weeks. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but probably some, yeah, touring and just like, yeah, exploring a new area. And hopefully sometime in the summer, I'll get to tour some of the Tour Divide and or the Great Divide mountain bike route, I guess it would be called, since I won't be racing it.
So you just named a whole bunch of events. And I guess my question is like, how do you make that work with the other things that you have going on in your life? Yeah. Are you, I think you mentioned remote work. Are you like, what do you do for work? Like, how do you like live this kind of like somewhat nomadic lifestyle? Like, how does that work for you?
Yeah, so I tried to pick about one event a month, which I thought seemed a bit more reasonable because, you know, it takes some time to prepare and get to the start and the finish, but more of the events are in my region, so they're, you know, not so difficult to get to. I work for the Federation of BC Writers, so we're a provincial nonprofit writing association, and we provide services like workshops on the craft and business of writing to people in every stage of their writing career. So people who are just, you know, picking up a pen for the first time and want to tell story, or folks working on their memoirs, people who are best-selling authors, kind of the gamut, and as well as poets and screenwriters and playwrights and stuff. So it's a pretty sweet gig. I work like 15 to 20 hours a week, and I'm able to kind of bank hours in the winter for the summer when I'm not able to do those hours. It ended up with me doing like a lot of weird like middle of the night meetings when I was in Europe last summer because of the time difference. Everyone's like, Megan, you look very like tired right now. Why is it dark outside? Like, it's 3 a.m, you guys. That's why. It's a really great gig for me, though, because as someone who is a writer myself, I really appreciate the work that we do. And it's great to get to talk to these people who are all working on really cool, interesting projects. And, you know, one of the things I do in like the outreach component of my job is I lead a group of travel writers, and like I facilitate a monthly workshop. So we just get together like once a month and talk about travel writing and share our work and critique it. I get to be the facilitator for that. So it's really great.
You wrote a book, correct, about your touring experiences?
Yeah, that's right. It's called Coast to Coast. Oh, no, sorry. It's called South Away, the Pacific Coast on Two Wheels. Megan, can't remember the title of your own book. And it's about cycling the Pacific Coast with my sister. And that was our first ever bike trip. It took place in 2009. So it's kind of like pre-smartphones. And we're navigating by like book and paper map and like calling our folks from payphones and just living the great dirtbag lifestyle down the coast into Mexico.
Very cool. Very cool. If the listeners want to learn more about you, keep up with your adventures, where would you send them?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's meganhakkinen.com, Megan with all the letters. And I'm also on Instagram under my name, which I guess could be in the show notes. But yeah, those are the two places to find me. And if you ever come to the Okanagan, like we have warm showers folks here all the time. So I'm always happy to host people and show them around because like I've had so much hospitality from bike touring. Like, it's great to be able to give that back and have these interesting people spend like a day or two of their trip with you, right?
Yeah, for sure. Megan, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. Everybody, thanks for listening to episode 26 of the Bike Pack Racing Podcast.